Back last year, after I spoke to Gary for the first time, and after I'd first started looking into this case, I think my only real goal was to try and figure out whether the things Gary was telling me were things that had actually happened. I wasn't planning to investigate the case, not really. And finding out how Grace had actually died seemed too ambitious, given how old the case was. But the stories Gary was telling me didn't sound like the kind of stories that could be true. Didn't sound like the kinds of things that happened in real life. And yet he'd also said he had records to verify much of what he was telling me. So I wanted to at least check that out. It couldn't hurt, right? And the thing of it was, there actually were records that backed up what Gary was telling me. And as I started doing my own investigation, finding new records and new witnesses, they also backed up what he told me. I didn't always agree with Gary's interpretation of the facts, or his theories about what had happened. Actually, I think I disagreed with him there more often than not. But the basic facts of the case, what he told me had happened, those things, again and again, checked out. They were true. And before long, the question I was trying to answer had shifted from, did all this actually happen? To, how could all of this have actually happened? Because how could Bo Salmon have actually done everything he seems to have done? How did he and the people he ran with get away with so much before he was finally stopped in 1981, after being convicted of the murder of Henry Ridley Jr.? And like I mentioned before, I think part of the answer is the whole rednecks killing rednecks thing. This sort of institutional aversion when the people involved were themselves bad guys or considered bad guys. Because in that case, why bother? But that's only part of the story. The other part, maybe the biggest part, was police corruption. As I would see again and again while investigating this case, corruption in law enforcement agencies was endemic in Northwest Georgia in the 60s and 70s, and no doubt many other places and many other times as well. But here, in the cases I was seeing, it's not like they were even really trying to hide it. And it wasn't just Georgia, that's for sure. GBI Director Vernon Keenan had been assigned up in Northwest Georgia back in those days, and he told me about a southern town outside of Georgia that had had it worse than most places did.
And had a corrupt sheriff and police department. That was generally, if you had a corrupt agency, the other one would be okay, but they had the bad luck of having both of them corrupt.
Director Keenan told me about the struggles the GBI often had in those days, about dealing with local law enforcement agencies and the problems there. Sometimes you'd try to investigate the criminals, only to find out that the local police were working with them hand in hand.
And we did the first auto theft wiretap up in Whitfield County, and actually called a Dalton police officer on the wiretap, tipping them off that we had an investigation going. Called him on the wiretap.
I have noticed that's kind of a common theme for the GBI in these cases. They're the ones catching the local police who are tipping off the targets.
Yeah, there was no one else to investigate the police. We had good prosecutors up there, though. That was a saving grace. They had good district attorneys. The weak link was law enforcement.
When I say police corruption is part of the story of Gary's conviction, I don't mean by the officers that were directly involved in the investigation of Grace's murder. Those officers did do a terrible job, and they made it so that we'll never have any of the answers that the crime scene might have been able to give us. But that wasn't the corrupt part. That was caused by, as Director Keenan put it in an earlier episode, the absence of a much-needed professionalism among many local law enforcement agencies. Again and again throughout the case, though, it seemed like there were opportunities where law enforcement could have halted the events that would happen, stopped what was unfolding, but again and again they failed to do so. And I don't just mean in Grace's case, but in all the cases Bo was linked in. Because investigating this case, it often felt like every time I turned over a rock, I'd find a new murder that Bo had been connected to in some way. Take, for instance, the ambush killing of Billy Kelly and Jack Patton in a Whitfield County cemetery. That murder was never solved, but when I got the GBI files, it was clear that the GBI at least had thought they'd known who done it, Bo Salmon. And that surprised me because Jack Patton had been a pretty close friend of Bo's. I'd first learned of Jack due to some crimes that he and Bo had done together, down in Floyd County. So I wasn't sure why the GBI might have thought Bo would be involved in his murder. I contacted Jack's niece, Teresa, and luckily enough, Teresa herself had done some investigation into her uncle's murder a couple decades back, and she still had her notes and files from the things she'd looked into back then. She also had some old family photos of Jack, which she showed me when I met with her and some of Jack's other relatives up in Dalton.
Jack was in prison at that time, wasn't he?
That's probably 50 years, isn't it, standing
in front of Jack?
That's Whitfield County, the old prison.
Teresa told me about how her father had learned of his brother's death, how no one had seen Jack since the night before, so when rumors started going about town about some bodies found up in the cemetery, Jack's family got worried.
Word had got to them that these bodies were found, and so they went to the cemetery to try to find out if it was Jack, and found out it was.
The investigation into the murders stalled out about as soon as it began. In fact, Jack's family got the sense they never really tried to solve it at all.
Yes, because of the record that Billy and Jack had, mm-hmm. you know, their past.
They had criminal records.
Yeah, and they just didn't really care.
Teresa had been too young when her uncle died to be that involved, and she never really knew much about the case until she decided to do her own investigation back in the 1990s. Unfortunately, she ran into the same problem that now in 2017 I ran into. The murder of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly is an open case, and the police files are not available. Still, back then, when she spoke to a detective about the case, he did give her some clues about where to look.
I really never did hear anything. Until I came up and met with the detective, and he pointed me in the direction of Bo Salmon.
The detective that she spoke to didn't get much more specific beyond that, but Teresa came away thinking the cops had known all along who was primarily responsible for her uncle's murder.
Well, in my notes somewhere, I remember the detective told me that he did not think that, he thought that Bo Salmon was involved, but he didn't think he was actually a trigger man because he was more talk than do.
When I talked to Benny Kelly, the son of Billy Kelly, the other victim in this case, he told me more or less the same thing. Word around town had always been that Bo was responsible. Though, like the Patton family, he had also suspected that the police had known a lot more than they let on. And when I spoke to the ex-wife of Billy Kelly, she got more detailed about what she'd always believed. She and Billy had separated before his death, but they'd remained close and on good terms, and she very much wanted his murder to be solved. Still, she said, she never thought that actually happened. In fact, she'd assumed there's a decent chance that law enforcement had been involved in the killing themselves one way or another, and therefore wouldn't be likely to try very hard to investigate it. She told me how, when the police came out to her house to talk to her about Billy's death, she hadn't wanted to, and she told them, well, did y'all cover up for the ones who done it, or did you have it done? Which, of course, made the police mad, and they left. But her concern that the police might have been involved in some way wasn't irrational, because yes, some elements of law enforcement in Whitfield County were for sure corrupt at that time. The sheriff would later be charged for cocaine and firearm conspiracies and serve time in prison. And it's clear that Bo and his group did enjoy some kind of mutually beneficial arrangement with local law enforcement. In fact, local law enforcement officers had, indirectly, provided assistance to the murder of Henry Ridley Jr. J.W. Patterson was one of the friends that Bo tried to recruit for the murder. However, he had actually turned informant and told the GBI about how Bo and Teddy Bear had been warned in advance that the police would be raiding their place that weekend. Which was handy, because Bo had been storing a .30-30 rifle there at Teddy Bear's place. And thanks to the heads up from the police, Bo was able to move the rifle to a safe location so the police couldn't seize it. And that rifle would later be used to kill Henry.
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your individual needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Now, I'm currently working on an amicus brief, that's a friend of the court brief for a state Supreme Court, and the organization I'm working for says it's often difficult to coordinate these things because you have to send a number of copies of the brief to the court, but they're listeners of the podcast, and they know that I use Stamps.com, and we both agreed, let's use Stamps.com, it makes life so easy. And now Stamps.com can make life easy for you too. Right now, you can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
Northwest Georgia is no longer quite the Wild West it once was, and I'm optimistic that many of the failures in the criminal justice system that went on in Gary's case and other cases from that time period would never happen today. But these failures of law enforcement, the corruption, the malfeasance, that's not some old-timey thing from a dead and bygone era. And I don't think things have changed quite as much as we'd like to think. I remember talking last year to a retired police officer, one who'd been involved in a tangential way to both the Gary Mitchum Reeves case and the Joey Watkins case. And I'd asked him about some of the stories Gary had told me about police tipping off local criminals. He told me simply, nothing's changed there. And he was right. Just this year, a Rome officer was arrested for the same old conspiracy as always, tipping off the drug dealers about when a raid's coming in. Or to take another example, Stanley Sutton. He was the lead investigator in our Season 2 case from 2000, but he was also a police officer back in the 70s. And sometimes it feels like I can't take a step in Floyd County without hearing another story about Stanley Sutton, about someone else's car he put dope in, or someone else he threatened to put away forever if they didn't implicate a friend of theirs in some crime or another.
I was on the grand jury when Stanley Sutton would bring cases, and you really had to sift out things that Stanley said because he was trying to make a name for himself.
That's all he done.
Put people in jail. I'm sure there were people went to prison that shouldn't have on Stanley.
I know one of them.
And to show just how little some things have changed in Rome in the past 40 years, here's a bit of a side story about how it is I came to find Gary's case in the first place. I've mentioned before that I stumbled on Gary's case while researching our Season 2 case, and that there were overlapping people and themes between the two cases. But I didn't say what the overlap was. And in a nutshell, it's that Bo Salmon isn't the only member of his family who has been involved in the contract killing business, or at least claimed to be involved in the contract killing business. In Season 2, we cover the Joey Watkins case. Joey was 19 at the time of the crime, and he was convicted of killing Isaac Dawkins, a former classmate who'd once dated the same girl Joey had dated. Supposedly, Joey and his friend Mark had been in a little blue car driving along a divided highway when they'd fired two shots at Isaac's pickup, with one shot going through the back window of Isaac's truck and hitting him in the back right side of his head. But there'd been a string of highway shootings in Rome that same year, and although none of the four or five other ones I came across had been solved or even really investigated, I was curious about them. And then one day, I was glancing through an old issue of the Rome News Tribune when I saw an article that stood out to me. 7 months after Isaac's death, a 25-year-old that I'll call JT had been driving in the southwest Rome area when someone had fired two shots at his pickup, with one shot going through the back window of his truck and hitting him in the back right side of his head. Luckily for JT, it was apparently some kind of reverse magic bullet that hit him because the shot wasn't fatal and didn't actually injure him that badly. But the similarities between the two shootings were startling. Claire from the GIP decided to pull the police records for JT's case, although it turned out there wasn't hardly anything to it beyond what was already reported in the newspaper. There was one notation that was new, though. 3 months after the shooting, someone had added a short update to the report. 1-12-2001. From incident date until October 4th, 2000, information that responding officer received, Cotton Salmon is the suspect. Victim is refusing to cooperate. Case cleared. Cotton Salmon is Bo Salmon's nephew, but at the time, I didn't know who Bo was and didn't know of Gary's case. I was already well aware of who Cotton Salmon was, though, and finding out that he'd been a suspect in a shooting that was all but identical to the one that killed Isaac 7 months before, that was startling for a few reasons. The first is that Cotton's sister and nephew had once talked to a PI hired by Joy's family and tried to convince the PI that a man named Joy Boyd had done the murder, even though their story couldn't be corroborated in any way, and I still don't understand the origins of it or why they were telling it to him. And the second is that Cotton Salmon was actually one of the jailhouse snitches in the Joey Watkins case. In fact, out of all the very many jailhouse snitches, Cotton had probably been the most accurate of all of them in describing the murder. He even knew the make of the pistol that had been used to kill Isaac, supposedly, or at least that the GBI's ballistics report claimed was used.
Okay, testing, 1, 2, 3. Had a little problems with the tape recorder, had to change batteries. Okay, this is Investigator Stanley Sutton. Today, I had went up to the Florida County Jail and interviewed, took a guy out by the name of Ronald Wayne Salmon. He's got a nickname Cotton. I've been knowing him about 30 years. But he was incarcerated in the same cell block as Mark Freed. But I received some information that Cotton Salmon had some information about Mark Freed, telling him about the killing of Isaac Dawkins and, you know, great detail. And so I pulled him out and talked to him today. And basically, what Cotton told me that he spent 5 months in the cell prior to Mark Freed going to trial this year, 2002, in February, that he bragged to Cotton that he was a hit man, that he hit moving targets, and that he was a 9mm expert sharpshooter, and told him all about the Army and about how that he could kill people, and that's what he was going to do. He was going to be a hit man. And he told Cotton that if he had anybody that he wanted hit, just to let him know, and he gave him his numbers and everything where he could get in touch with him when he got out.
I was never able to find any evidence that could link in any way Cotton Salmon to Isaac's killing, and I don't think he was involved there. But what I find remarkable is just how comfortable Stanley Sutton's relationship was with Cotton. Because remember, Sutton had to have known that at the time Cotton came to him with the story, Cotton himself had been the lead suspect, the only suspect, in a shooting that came a hair's breadth away from being a murder. But the police had closed the case, apparently without much investigation, and that was that. Then, when Cotton came forward to tell Sutton about Mark being a hitman responsible for Isaac's murder, Sutton considered a reliable source, no questions asked. So why would the Floyd County Police have so abruptly discontinued their investigation into a very near murder that Cotton seems to have been involved in, and yet they were so gung-ho in accepting a story about a jailhouse confession? I can't help but remember some of the things I've heard in Floyd County over and over again about Sutton.
Well, Stanley protected some of his people that would tell him stuff.
To try and figure out why exactly the investigation into Cotton Salmon had been dropped, Claire reached out to JT, the victim in the case.
We came across, in the course of investigating his case, an incident where your name was mentioned, where you were shot in the back of the head by your above your ear and survived. Our client is accused of doing the same thing to someone. Well, convicted of doing the same thing to someone else. And so I was just wondering if you would be willing to talk with me at all about what happened in your case. So, I guess the police thought that Cotton Salmon did it. Okay, so the police report said that you had decided not to prosecute. So if they had found who it was, you would have wanted to prosecute?
JT was reluctant to talk and didn't want to give too many details. But he did tell Claire about the events that led to him being shot in the back of the head.
So he had he says he had a trailer on his property that was full of stuff that got stolen, and about a week later, he saw it driving down the road, someone driving it down the road, in a dark, the driver had a dark truck. So he did a U-turn, got in front of the truck, tried to get the truck to stop, and that's when he got shot. He was looking in the rearview mirror.
But as for whether Cotton had been the shooter that he'd seen in the rearview mirror, that he couldn't say.
Yeah, but it's pretty clear he didn't want to implicate him.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
All I know is every time Cotton Salmon's name comes up, people get scared.
Yeah.
Right?
A little bit.
I mean, that's what I've noticed in like 2 days. Anytime it comes up, I don't want none of that.
Last year, I played Cotton Salmon's statement to Mark for the first time. Mark had known, of course, that Stanley Sutton had used a lot of snitches in the case against him. People who'd claim that he or Joey had confessed in jail. But Mark had never known that Cotton Salmon was one of them.
Have you ever heard that before?
I've never heard that. First of all, Cotton, I'm talking about a hit. Cotton Salmon come to me about wanting to put a hit on somebody at a lake in Alabama. One of the guys killed one of the Hell's Angel brothers, something like that. And
so Cotton did approach you about a hit?
Yeah, he did. I said, I'm not a hitman. I don't do that kind of stuff.
Maybe Cotton's offer was legit, but I don't buy it. I have to imagine that if Cotton really needed to hire a hitman, some skinny kid he met in Floyd County Jail, that would be an awfully long way down his list of top choices. But Cotton was persistent in his efforts to recruit Mark.
And gave me details and everything about the man, the tattoo, and this and that. I kept telling him, I said, man, I'm not into that kind of stuff. I said, I don't do that.
My guess? Cotton never had any intent to hire Mark as a hitman. He was trying to get Mark to say something incriminating, to do something that would give him some kind of dirt, so that he could report it to Stanley Sutton, the police officer that he'd been known for about 30 years.
ModCloth is your go-to spot for fashion as unique as you. ModCloth believes that fashion is for every body, size, and shape. That's why their exclusive line of apparel is offered in a full size range from extra extra small to 4X. ModCloth is the go-to source for unique women's fashion. They specialize in a broad range of styles from quirky statement prints, vibrant colors, retro dresses, classic silhouettes, and cool contemporary clothing. You can even get free sizing and fit and styling help from their team of mod stylists. Effortlessly transition between seasons with summer styles that stay perfectly preserved for fall. Now I can say that recently I got my wife the Library Love Striped cardigan from ModCloth, and everyone including me was commenting on how great she looked. And now you can do the same. Go to modcloth.com and enter promo code undisclosed at checkout to get 30% off your order of $100 or more. Make every day extraordinary at ModCloth.
So as for Gary's case, as for how all this was able to happen, that's the best I've got. About how Beau was able to carry on for so long, why it took so long for anyone to care. It's these patterns of selective enforcement of the law, of special privileges given to certain criminals, and a let the rednecks kill the rednecks mentality, as well as a it's okay to get the right guy for the wrong crime mentality. All of that led up to what we saw in Floyd County and in Murray and Whitfield counties. All of that was how someone like Beau Salmon was able to exist. But there's still another question to be addressed here as well, of course, and that's what actually happened to Grace that night, on August 13th, 1974. Unless and until more witnesses come forward, there are some questions here that we just won't be able to answer. We won't be able to know what happened, not exactly. But I do think I've got a pretty good idea. And it all goes back to why exactly Gary got paroled in 1981. From the start, Gary's story there just seemed incomplete. Yeah, it's possible he was paroled 7 years into a life sentence for normal, everyday reasons, despite the fact he showed no remorse for his crime because he was claiming innocence. But shortly before he was paroled, Gary was told something that seemed potentially relevant. That the GBI had an informant who said Gary hadn't even been there when Grace was killed. And if I could find that informant, assuming they existed, maybe I could learn more about why Gary had been released from prison, and about who had really killed Grace. So I spent the next couple months tracking down GBI records, and I got a break. There were several informants in the GBI files, and two of them were informants that came forward saying they had knowledge not just about the Henry Ridley Jr. murder, but about other murders Bo had done as well. Confidential informant 167 didn't have a name, and gender-neutral pronouns were used, so I still don't even know if it's a woman or a man. But the other informant, number 166, her identity was not well hidden. She was actually Beverly Inslee, the woman who had testified against Bo at both of his trials, both for arson and murder. Only Beverly wasn't her real name. That was just an alias she'd adopted. Her real name was Lana, and she was the reason the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as opposed to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, had been involved in the Bo Salmon case in the first place. She had been a bank robber, which is apparently what had drawn the Fed's attention. And it also seemed that she'd worked out some kind of deal, which is why she did testify against Bo at trial twice. Once for arson, for the firebombing of the office, and once at his murder trial for the killing of Henry Ridley Jr. But then also a third time, against Bo's co-defendants in the murder, Teddy Bear Mulkey and Earl Green. I didn't know much about her, though, beyond what's in the transcripts of her testimony at the trials, but I was finally able to track her down and give her a call. I wasn't sure if she'd want to talk to me. As you might expect, you don't always get a friendly response when you call up someone out of the blue to ask about their involvement in a murder from 40 years ago. But sometimes you do. When I told Lana that I was investigating the Henry Ridley Jr. murder, and that I was calling her because I'd found her name in the court and GBI files, she began telling me about the events led up to that, everything that had happened back then. I never got a chance to tell her about the other cases I was looking into, or about how I'd originally started looking at a case that happened back in Floyd County. And then she brought the case up herself, right as, from the sound of it, she was driving through a tunnel, and I couldn't be sure that I'd heard what I thought I had.
Well, one of the ladies, if you call them, she was the one that Bo lived with.
Charlotte?
Charlotte. Bo had killed her mother already. And she laid it off on her.
The phone just dropped out for a second. What'd you say?
I said Bo Salomon. Mm-hmm. He had killed Charlotte's mother years ago, so he was going on her in Rome, Georgia. And her husband, boyfriend, or whatever it was, got sent off for that. And I tried to tell those people back then, that's not who did that. Bo did that. And they said, well, how can you say it? I said, because he told me that he went in there and he poured liquor and stuff all over himself and got on the couch, and they said they couldn't even move him. I said, because he didn't want you to move him. But he shot the man through the window, through the kitchen window, or shot the woman, not the man. And the husband got sent off for it, the boyfriend or whatever. But see, he did stuff like that. They were wicked. They were mean. They would kill you.
So he shot Charlotte's mother?
He killed Charlotte's mother, yes, and the husband got blamed for him.
Do you know why he killed her?
Well, he went out with her. He was dating her. Behind the back, he was, and she didn't want to leave that guy, so he killed her. He walked around the house and shot her through the window, kitchen window.
I had a million questions for Lana. 5 million. But she had an appointment to make and had to get off the call, so she promised to call me later. That evening, she did call back, and this time, she was slightly more reticent than before. She had noticed my phone number was a Georgia number, even though I told her I lived in Washington, D.C. And that got her wondering, was I really in D.C., or was I from Georgia? After all, she had people in Georgia who might still hold a grudge against her. So she asked, who was I again, and why did I want to know about her role in the trials for the office burning and for the murder of Henry Ridley Jr.?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for calling back. Is now a good time to chat?
Yeah. Now, you have a Georgia number.
I do. I'm from Georgia. I live up in D.C. now, but I kept the old cell phone.
Oh, okay. I knew that's a Georgia number. I've got to ask you a question. What got you started thinking about Henry?
So it's a few things. What I do like a sort of an internet radio show on legal justice issues.
Uh-huh.
And but I don't only do this, but one of the main things I focus on is wrongful convictions. And there's a man down in Floyd County who was convicted of a murder of his wife that he says he didn't do.
He's dead, isn't he?
He is. But the man convicted of the murder is not. And that was the murder of Charlotte Salmon's mother.
Honestly, he didn't do that. He didn't do that.
How do you know that?
Because Bo told me. But I mean, you know, I worked with these people. When mm-hmm. I say I worked with these people, you know what I mean. I mean,
that's
I did
work.
Things with these people. Oh, yes, and it paid you a lot of money, and then you got a lot of problems. But I do know that Mr. Salmon told me, Mr. Bo, we were riding along one day, and we were talking. I said, look, I'm not going for anything to kill someone. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. That's not what I do. And if that's what you know, I'd never get me involved in anything like that. So he said, but it's easy. You can, you know, it's easy. I've done it before. And I said, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean? Who? What? Do I know? And he said, no. And he told me the story of Rome, Georgia, that he was going with her mom. And her mom did not want to leave that guy. And so he walked around and he shot the guy through the kitchen window. He shot him. No, I mean the woman. And then he ran in there. He said, and I poured a whole bottle of liquor on myself, laid on the couch, and pretended I was passed out. And he said, so he had, you know, I mean, that's just the way it was. And the guy did not do that. I said, all those years ago to the ATF and the FBI, the man did not do that. And, you know, Bo gave all the facts and how he did it and everything, and I believe he told the truth. I do not believe the man did it.
It was kind of hard to process everything Lana told me because it was just so unexpected. But one thing in particular stood out to me. The only person that Lana could have gotten this information from was Bo Salmon himself. She didn't have any firsthand knowledge about the murder of Charlotte's mother, and she hadn't even met Bo until a couple of years after it happened. And she didn't know anyone else involved in the case except for Charlotte, who she knew through Bo. So everything Lana was telling me, that was something Bo had once told her. She didn't know and couldn't have known anything else about the case aside from what had come from him. In fact, she'd assumed that this man, whoever it was, who was convicted of the murder of Charlotte's mother, that he was still in prison. Because the law enforcement officer she'd spoken to, they told her that they couldn't really do anything. That was beyond their control. But she'd always wondered what had happened to that man, and she was glad to hear when I told her that he hadn't spent the rest of his life in prison after all. Lana still lives in the South, up in the Appalachian Mountains, where she's helping raise grandkids and working on her garden. She left Whitfield County years ago, after Bo's trials, and she never looked back. If it wasn't for a friend she visits there from time to time, I don't think she'd ever go to Georgia. Too many bad memories. And, as luck would have it, when I met with Lana, there was a pretty fierce storm coming in, so fair warning, sound quality is not always the best. Back in the late 70s, Lana had been living in Dalton. That's how she met Bo Salmon and the rest of the folks he hung around with.
I worked at a small bar starting off called the Pub. I think that was the name of it. But, you know, my brother shot pool at that Sportsman Tavern. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met Bo and Jack Patton and Teddy Bear, Randa Williams, and, you know, Johnny Vaughn, a lot of people. And you just knew them, and then you kind of, you know, knew them out of work. You got to know them. You were looking for a certain kind of people. I was looking for a certain kind of people to help me do something.
Lana didn't hang around in the Sportsman herself. That was Bo's favorite bar, maybe, but it wasn't really a place you'd go to relax.
I don't think any place I've ever saw was quite like the Sportsman. It was like rough and rugged. You better know what you're doing when you get in there. I remember this one guy was a good guy. He worked. He came in there to have a beer one morning. And there was this gal from Louisiana named Cherie, and she was with this one guy. And he and the guy that worked got in a fuss, Cherie's boyfriend. And Charles Carroll, I think, was that guy's name. And he got up and beat the crap out of Cherie's boyfriend. And Cherie gave the guy a butcher knife. And when Charles got up on the stool, I'm sure it was Charles Carroll, then that guy stabbed him through the back with a butcher knife and killed him.
In the bar.
There's what you got.
But living in Dalton could be hard, and not just because of the violence. Financially, it was a struggle as well. And Lana was a single mother as well. And raising four children on a bartender's salary, that wasn't going to cut it. Looking back now, she has a lot of regrets about the life she got into in Dalton. The risks and the consequences have been far greater than she'd imagined at the start. And besides, it was just the wrong way to live your life. But at the time, it had all seemed to make sense.
You know, I mean, we robbed banks. That's what we did. But that's what, you know, that was what my thing was.
Can I ask how you
did it? It's not for that bunch. Well, you know, it was a no nonsense bunch of stuff. You better know what you were doing. Today you wouldn't do that because you know and I know everything's computerized, everything's more upbeat on the ball. Police are different; they're smarter.
But back in the day, back before modern technology, Lana's methods worked well enough, and she couldn't see any reason that being a woman should stop her from getting into the field.
It was just like. Men were the ones that got to do things and make money. And then you just think, why does the men get always considered? Why are they the people?
She was only interested in serious jobs, not the penny ante stuff, as she put it, that Bo and his crew like to do. Lana figured if you were going to do a crime, then make sure no one gets hurt and make sure the payday is worth it. So what she was interested in, what she wanted to do, were the high-profile jobs.
If you're going to go, if you want to go make money, but be able to, you know, how am I going to say this? Be able to do your part with a calm head. Don't be drunk. Don't be drugged. Know what you're doing and know who you're doing it with. So your whole thing depends on who you're doing it with.
Which is why, although she'd become friends with Bo Salmon, he was not someone she worked with professionally, not for the big stuff. Sometimes she would do penny ante stuff and they'd work together for that, but Bo was a liability. He wasn't someone you could trust to do any kind of serious deals with. When Bo testified in his own defense, though, at his murder trial, he'd given a slightly different explanation for why he'd never been involved in the bank robberies.
You wouldn't have been able to hear the testimony because you were a witness too, but Bo testified at one of the trials that he was saying you only testified against him because you were mad at him because you'd asked him to help with a bank robbery and he'd said no.
That's a lie. I thought it was when
we
I read
would
that.
Never have listen, we would never have taken him. No.
Oh, so he
no,
was no
he
good.
Shot drugs. Bo lied. I would never. Well, why would you want to take a chance on going to do something with somebody and maybe he would leave you laying and take all the money?
It's a crazy life, Susan, and people can say, well, what was she doing there? What were any of them doing around it? Well, it's just a lifestyle. When you get involved in a lifestyle like that, things seem normal to you that's not normal. And when other people look on people like me and all those people and say, every one of them should have been run into prison. Well, maybe we should have. Maybe we should have. And, like I said, it was just wild, crazy, long ago and far away days. It was a bunch of it fun. Sure it was. Until, like I said, people got hurt.
Over time, while working at the bar, Lana had gotten to know Bo and Teddy Bear, and they spent a lot of time together. She was probably closer to Teddy Bear overall, and certainly thought better of him overall, but she and Bo would hang out too. He even had a nickname for her,
Though I think his choice of nickname says a lot more about Bo than it does about Lana.
He told me, he said, because everybody said, you're beautiful, and he said, ugly. And he called me Ugg, or short for ugly.
Lana liked Bo well enough, though friends isn't a term she'd use to describe him. Or anyone she hung out with at that time, really.
Well, not in that kind of lifestyle. You have no friends, really.
And Bo's drug use meant that, even though they could be friends, doing serious jobs with him was not an option.
Well, like I said, he's no one I would have used in a grand plan. Because, you know, if you got to stop and do some drugs, you don't need to be doing too much.
Bo fancied himself a pool shark. That was one way he made money. And according to Gary, he was quite good. That's part of why Gary had invested in the pool table in Grace's beer joint. It brought in customers, and Bo could play and make money. But in Dalton, Bo's reputation as a pool player was decidedly more mixed. And according to Lana, Bo did have success in pool tournaments. It's just that his success shouldn't necessarily be attributed to his skills as a pool player.
When I met Bo, I realized he was involved in a lot of stuff. He considered himself to be a major pool shooter. But he did put a lot of stuff and a lot of people to drinks to win money in pool tournaments. And, you know,
he would drug the competition?
He would. I mean, among other things, yeah.
It wasn't just when playing pool, though, that Bo had a habit of using drugs as a way of getting an advantage over other people. Lana told me about one incident with Bo, a time when he'd offered her drugs, and to her, it had been a signal that something was very wrong.
Someone had told me that I needed to be really careful because there was Randall that wanted me killed, and I wondered if Bo was the one that he was going to ask. Anyway, my crazy mind, I got right in the car and said, you know, let's go, I'll get you something, and we'll go get something to eat. Then he didn't want to go get anything to eat, and he started fixing me a shot of morphine. I said, what are you doing? And he said, you know, he was going to do, and he did his, and he started fixing another one. And he said, I said, what are you doing, taking another one? And he said, no, I'm fixing this for you. And I said, you know, I don't do drugs, and you're not fixing it for me. I said, I don't get into crap like that. But see, in his mind, he thought, maybe she will, and it'll be easy this way. But, and I had a 357 stuck down by the car door, but he knew I had it down over there, that I always had it there. And it was in the fall of the year. It's late fall, and the moon was out. It's a cool night. And he said, pull over right here. And he got out and stood, and he said, and I seen his hand go down to his belt line where he had a gun there. And he said, get out, and let's look at the moon. I said, oh. Get in the car. You need to get in the car. And I've got to go. I've got to go pick my kids up. And, you know, it was, I mean, he could have tried, but I'm sure I was sitting in a position to kill him before he could ever think, because I would have just, of course, I would have had to shoot him. And he told me going back, you know, over there, and I said, what are you doing? What are you thinking about? And he said, you don't understand. There's a lot of money riding out here. So I don't know who the money was riding from. But anyway, thank God in heaven it didn't happen. And we didn't have to do the old Western thing.
Lana doesn't know for sure what Bo's plans were that night or what money he was talking about. But she's pretty sure that if she had gotten out of the car that night, things wouldn't have gone well for her. And she also knew about other murders Bo had done. Some of them anyway. The stuff Bo had told her. Like the cemetery murders, where Jack Patton and Billy Kelly were ambushed and killed in 1978.
He said Billy got what was coming to him. I said that was kind of bad about them, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he just kind of had this crazy old life. And he said, he got what was coming to him.
But he didn't mention Jack getting what?
No, he did not. He never mentioned Jack, but they would have had to kill Jack, because Jack would have come back to him.
Lana knew that Bo had believed that Charlotte had had a relationship with Billy Kelly and wouldn't break it off. As Lana took it, that is why Bo had him killed. And Lana knew others involved in the case. Bo hadn't gone to the cemetery alone, and they told Lana more or less the same story she'd gotten from Bo. That it was Billy Kelly he'd wanted to kill, not Jack Patton. Jack had been Bo's friend, and his death was sort of a necessary accident, but not really intended.
Well, he wasn't planned. It wasn't a planned thing for Jack to be there. But they knew they were set up when they pulled into the graveyard. And they could never have let Jack go because Jack would have come back and killed them both.
Jack ran.
Jack tried to get away. Yeah, he tried to get away when he saw what was going on.
I told Lana about Charlotte's statement, the one she'd given to the GBI about the murders. And when she described what Bo had told her, supposedly, about how the murders happened. There were a few parts of Charlotte's story that made Lana's eyebrows rise. But the basic outline of it, she thought that was right. Or at least it was more or less the same story she'd heard all those years ago.
And she can, you know, sit there and say, well, it's mainly over me. Well, not the Jack thing wasn't. He was just there. He, you know, I don't think they expected him to be. But anyway, point being is, the people are dead. And there's never going to be any kind of investigation for all that. That was a done deal. Bo's dead, and he would have been the main player in that.
Lana had remained friends with Bo after the cemetery murders. And when explaining this part of her life now to me, she kept describing how, yes, in hindsight, obviously, from the perspective of a normal human being, that's something that can be hard to fathom. But back then, in the life she was living, they were all living, in that mindset she'd had at the time, that's just how things had been.
It's just like this person you had to become in your head to survive.
But the murders of Jack Patton and Billy Kelly were one thing. Then, in 1980, Henry Ridley Jr. was murdered, and that was a different thing entirely.
Was I surprised when he killed Billy and Jack? No. Surprised that he killed Jack, but I guess that had to be. But really surprised that he would have done the thing with Henry, really. No one should think that way.
Both Teddy Bear and Bo had been involved in Henry's murder, which had horrified her. But even after it happened, she still regarded Teddy Bear a bit differently from Bo.
But I think with Bo, it was different than Bear. It was a thing. It was a thrill. It was a, like trapping an animal in a headlight. You know, I think that he got a thrill out of plotting and planning and hurting people.
There's one incident from after Henry's death that stands out in Lana's memory, although Lana still can't quite make sense of it.
After Henry got killed, after they murdered Henry Ridley, someone had a goat at the barbecue. They were going to barbecue a goat. And Bo says, no, I'm keeping that goat. You're not going to hurt that goat. So he got the goat for his kids. It was okay to kill little Henry, but it was not okay to barbecue the goat.
He took the goat to the vet.
Yes. They had it. They made a pet out of it.
Lana's story gave me an answer to one small question anyway that I'd had. In the GBI files, it describes how, in the middle of covering up for Henry's murder, Bo and Charlotte had made a side trip to take a goat to the vet, which had seemed odd and random to me. But at least now I know where that goat came from. It wasn't just Lana who'd been upset by Henry's death, though. Even for most of Bo's group, even by their extremely loose standards, for many of them, the killing of Henry was a bridge too far. Or at least nothing they wanted any involvement with. Basically, all of them had known that Bo was part of that murder, though, because as far as I can tell, there's hardly anyone Bo knew that he didn't try to recruit to help with it.
I even, the guy Pistol Whitener, now he was a character, but even he backed off from the kid.
Oh, so he didn't, he was not.
Bo had talked to him, just like he did other people, you know. And you got to think, that was rather silly to go around.
Why did Bo do this?
Why did he go around and say, do you want to help me do this? And I mean, you know, that's not even scratching the surface on him. Do you want to do this and that? And a lot of people would say, no, no. But we would all know what he was wanting to do.
Why would he do that?
And that's just who he was, I guess.
He just went around and asked for help for murders.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they were all guilty, since that's why Pistol Whitener, if I recall correctly, he had went to prison for killing his wife.
Bo hadn't tried to recruit Lana's help, not for that crime, but she had been informed of Henry's death in advance, something she still grapples with today.
Sometimes when you go back on memory lane, it's like, shouldn't you have said something to somebody somewhere? And I think, no, because I would have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I wasn't totally, I was a thrill seeker, but it wasn't that crazy.
By the time Lana was involved, by the time she knew anything, Bo had already tried to kill Henry 3 or 4 times and failed 3 or 4 times. And then one night, Bo, Teddy Bear, and Henry pulled up to the house she was staying in, and Teddy Bear came to the door.
When Bear said I had borrowed the gun from Bo or Bear 1 for something and that I needed it for, and not to kill anybody, but I had kept the shells. I hadn't gave him back the shells. And that night, he came by and he needed the shells back. And I said, what you guys going to do? And he said, we're going up to the mountain and going to go deer hunting. And this person that was at my house, I remember him sitting there and he was watching me and watching my reaction to all that, you know. And I said, and he told me, he said, when they had left the driveway, he said, you know where they're going, don't you? And I said, deer hunting? And he says, no, they're taking that boy up there to kill him. I said, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, what can we do? And he said, what is it to you? It's none of your business. What do you mean? What can you do? And I remember him sitting there, Susan, he was staring at me and he was watching me, and because he and I did a lot of high profile stuff together, I thought, he's going to watch me and see how I'm going to react to all this.
In reality, I think Lana was right, that by the time she knew what was going on, there just wasn't much of anything she could have done, not as things were then in 1980. It reminded me in some ways of the story Gary told me about the time he and his friend Dink had delivered a rifle to Judge Scoggin, and Dink had told him of what would happen next. There was little that Lana or Gary could have done to change future events. Likely nothing they could have done. And in the case of Henry, people had tried to intervene already, tried to make Henry understand what was happening. It just hadn't worked.
Where were you going to go? Who were you going to tell? Were you going to tell the killer cops? Were you going to tell Jack Davis, the sheriff that ran the drugs? You know, he was the biggest drug dealer down there. Well, who were you going to say? They're trying to take somebody up there and kill him. But, you know, it just was not possible. And would he have believed it if I had caught him up and said, look, stop being an idiot. They're going to try to kill you.
He was warned. He was just a dumb kid.
In the end, there was nothing Lana could do that night that Bo and Bear and Henry came to her door. But there was one thing she could do afterwards. She could turn state's evidence. It wasn't Henry's death alone that made Lana come forward. Not that by itself. Henry's death helped push her over the edge. But everything changed for her when a federal agent showed up on her doorstep one day, not long after Henry's death.
The ATF agent came with a subpoena to go to court, and I said no. And he said, you better listen to me. Walter Holden made a deal that said I drove the car where they took when it jumped out and blew the nightclub up.
Walter Squeaky Holden. As far as I can tell, Squeaky was the linchpin that set all the prosecutions against Bo in motion. And he'd saved his own skin in doing so, and got a good deal for it. Of course, Squeaky, by himself, was hardly enough to get the job done. He just wasn't all that credible. But what he could do was give the investigators leverage over other witnesses, more credible witnesses, other people who could testify against Bo at the arson and murder trials. And one of the people he could give them was Lana.
He said, we're going to have there's some FBI agents going to come talk to you. You're going to get a choice. You're going to either tell the truth or you're going to, we're going to remove your children and you're going to prison. So when not wanting my kids to be put into foster care, if I had not had children involved, it would have been a different story. I might not have been the PTA mom, but if I didn't work a 9-to-5, I still tried to, you know, to make sure they had clothes, went to school, and the normal things. I didn't want those kids taken into the Department of Social Service, so I said, okay. And then I thought about it, and I thought, why do I care anyway? They killed Henry Ridley.
When Lana talked to the GBI as part of the investigation into Bo's various crimes, as well as things that Lana herself had been involved in without Bo, one of the things Lana told them was that a murder that Bo had told her he'd done in Floyd County. One day, when they'd been riding along, Bo had tried to recruit her as a hitman and told her a story about just how easy it was to get away with murder.
When I met Bo, after I'd met him, known him for a while, and when he said, what is your game? And I said, well, what is your game? And he said, I was driving, he was sitting, and he said, killing people is my game, Ugg. And I said, I'll be ridiculous. And he said, no, I'm very serious. He said, we could do a good business together, you and I. And I said, well, it depends on what kind. He said, what did I just say? And I said, you are so silly. And he said, let me tell you how easy this is. And then he told me about a lady named Grace, that he shot her through the kitchen window. And then he poured a bottle of liquor over himself and ran in and lay down like he was passed out. And he said, they came in, and he said, they knew I couldn't have done it because why not? I'm passed out.
Lana didn't know much about Beau's motive in the murder. Or rather, from what she understood, the motive was about as simple and straightforward as it gets. A simple narrative of a lover scorned.
He made a remark one time that he wanted the mother but got the daughter.
She had something. She owned a little beer joint or something.
She
down
did.
There.
She did.
Yes. And Beau was in there helping out and all that stuff. That's how he got involved in the, you know, and he wanted her and she didn't want him when it came down to it. She wanted the other man and he killed her.
Beau never mentioned Gary's name or any details about him, really. All he'd said was that Grace had been with another man and that man had been the one to go down for her murder.
He just said an old boy down there got, I said, well, who, surely the police had to get someone for killing that woman. And he said, well, they did. And he thought that was real funny. And he said, but it wasn't me. And I said, well, what happened to the person? He said, they went to prison. That's what happened to them. And I always wondered if he lied. And, you know, once I had an opportunity to ask this person that was a GBI agent, and I asked him, I said, is this true? Could this possibly be true? Because I had met him down there. And I said, could you find out if there is an innocent man somewhere in jail for this murder? And then he told me, he said, yes, there is. There is.
After I spoke to Lana, she listened to the podcast and for the first time heard some of the details about what had actually gone down in Floyd County and how Gary had been convicted. But from the very first episode, there was one thing Lana didn't get. When Gary woke up in that jail cell with no memory of what had happened, why did he not know instantly what had occurred?
When I heard your podcast there about the guy can't remember, and it was like, I asked you, I said, why can't he remember to know if he knew Beau, what Beau did? Beau's drug of choice was a Quaalude or a morphine.
So if Gary had known Beau well, he would have known that's what Beau did?
Yeah, he would have. I'm sure he would have.
Gary hadn't known Beau well, though. Hadn't known about his methods of getting an advantage over others. So for Beau, getting away with murder in this case had been as simple as he told Lana.
They come in and they had to pick him up and drag him off. He said, "But he said I was aware of the whole thing." And he said, "Now do you see how easy?" And I said, "That's awful. Someone is sitting somewhere. He thought it was fun. And he would laugh. He's so crazy life." And he said, "That's life, that's life."
As far as Lana could tell, her story about Grace's murder was forgotten by the authorities just as soon as she told it. That wasn't a case they were working on, and that wasn't something they could help her with. That's just how life was. And then later, after the trials, after Beau and Bear and Earl Green were convicted, Lana left Georgia. She kind of had to, because there were other cases she'd been involved with, other cases she'd helped on, and those involved people who were truly dangerous.
You were in witness protection, right?
I tried that. I just wanted to see what it was like.
It wasn't for you.
No.
Well, what happens when they put you in witness protection?
Oh, well. Well, they say, sell your car, you know, let's get you, you know, we're going to take you and we're going to do all this stuff. And just for my own, you know, one more time, let's get on a little adventure here and see what all this is about. But it wasn't from that mess. You know, that was not what...
Oh, this was for the other mess.
Oh, yeah. This was not anything to do with those bozos.
She chose a new name, Tony, with an I. Because, as she told me, why the heck not? But under the Witness Protection Program, she got assigned to a state in the Northeast, a far cry from the Appalachian Mountains that she'd grown up in and spent most of her life around. And when it came to choosing between the Dixie Mafia who wanted to kill her and living around Yankees, the choice was obvious. She left Witness Protection and went home and tried to start a new life there.
You have to come to this point in your life where you have to come to realize that things just need to be as normal in people's lives as they can be just do the 9-to-5 thing, just do the family thing, you know, just try to be normal.
So what happened to you after the trial? After the trial for Beau and Earl Green and them?
Well, I came back home and tried to be normal.
I'm not so sure that the GBI didn't do anything about the story Lana had told them. The GBI seemed very much interested in what she'd said, or at least Agent Bill Dodd, the lead investigator, did. Charlotte told me that he'd questioned her about it back in 1981. He'd brought up the case and asked her if Beau had been involved, and she told him no, he was off track. The right man was already behind bars for it. But Dodd's files don't reflect anything about the Floyd County case. Perhaps he has files elsewhere under some GBI case number that I haven't found yet. And if so, I'd like to be able to find it one day, and maybe there's answers there. But here's the thing. Lana was an informant who told the GBI about Grace's murder, but she was not the informant that I was originally looking for. She's not the witness that Gary was told about back in 1981 when Officer Jerry Boyd pulled him into his office and told him that the GBI said they had an informant who said he wasn't even there when Grace was killed. Lana had no clue about where Gary was or was not at the time of the murder. That hadn't been a part of any stories that Beau told her. Which means there's another informant out there somewhere. Actually, we know for a fact there is, because there's at least one other informant that the GBI got info from. Bill Dodd's files say as much. In addition to Lana Inslee, CI-166, there was also CI-167, and I've yet to be able to discover who CI-167 really is. They may be dead, or maybe one of the witnesses who decided not to speak to me, or maybe it's someone it never even occurred to me could have been one of the GBI's confidential informants. For now, though, Lana's story is what we have, and there's plenty there I'm still struggling to understand. I am convinced that Beau told Lana the things she describes. What I'm less certain of is whether Beau was telling her the whole truth. And Lana's story still can't tell us everything about what happened that night, because Beau didn't tell Lana everything. She only knows the parts she heard, and she hadn't even really cared to hear even that at the time. But parts of the story that Beau told Lana are definitely true. Like, the part about Beau seeming passed out when the police got there. That's exactly what the police and Beverly had observed after the murder, and why they were so confident that Beau hadn't been involved in Grace's death. But according to Lana, it had all been a pretty transparent act, really. He'd dumped liquor on himself and pretended to be passed out, and everyone else just assumed he really was. Other parts of Lana's story were completely out of left field for me, though. Like, the part about Beau and Grace having a relationship. That I hadn't seen suggested before. Gary had never mentioned that he'd had any clue that Beau and Grace had anything but a platonic relationship. I had floated the idea to him before, once or twice, as one of a thousand random ideas I was trying out. But he'd said no, he'd seen nothing to suggest that. And it's not just that he'd failed to notice. If there had been something going on, he said, he thinks he would have noticed.
I didn't see any flirting with them on that. I've seen Grace flirt around, you know, but I never did notice anything there.
So you would have noticed flirting. You just didn't notice flirting with Beau.
I would have noticed it, but I never saw that with her with Beau.
I am less than completely convinced by this. There are things that Grace hid from him, secrets she kept that he hadn't had a clue about. Her history with Beau could have been one of them. And I do know that Beau and Grace knew each other from before Beau went to prison for attempted murder, back in the 60s. Grace and Gary didn't get together until about 1968, and by then, Beau was already locked up. But before then, in the mid-60s, the early 60s, they knew each other. They were friends, or maybe more than friends. And after Beau got out of prison again in 1974, he'd started a relationship with Grace's daughter, Charlotte. And that had bothered Gary some. Charlotte wasn't his kid. He had no authority over her as a parent. But it had obviously been a bad situation, and Gary couldn't understand why Grace was okay with it.
When I first started planning to realize I'd made a bad mistake was that Daytona trip. I knew then that this was not good when she started telling Beau Salmon how proud she would be to have him as a son-in-law. And I remember thinking, you have lost it. Of course, she was drunk, and she would, probably was ribbing me at that.
I think Bo was probably being truthful when he told Lana that he'd had a relationship with Grace and that he'd wanted her, but she wouldn't leave Gary. I'm not sure, though, about whether his story about the motive, about why he'd done it and why he'd done it then, I'm not convinced that part's the whole truth. On the day that Grace died, Gary had already made up his mind to leave. He was tired of the chaos, tired of what life in Rome was like, and the beer joint wasn't working out either. Grace had gotten into some financial and legal troubles with a guy that was essentially the landlord, and it was not going to end well. Gary was done with Rome, and if Grace hadn't been killed that night, Gary would have been gone the next day or maybe the one after, headed back to Atlanta probably with his son, Sean, and tried to get his old job back or found a new one. But his plan hadn't been simply to disappear in the night. Grace knew Gary wanted out and that he was going to leave.
Grace was in a mess.
The bar was going down one way or another, pretty much.
The bar was gone. The bar was history. I told her, look, if you want to get away from this, I'll figure out some way. We'll come up with the money, you know, whatever you owe the guy. Let's go to the mountains. Get away from here for a while. Because I did try to get her to leave with me.
And she didn't say no?
She didn't say no, no.
She didn't say yes either. She wasn't ready to go. But things were still up in the air, and the possibility at least was there. And this reminds me of one of the things Beverly told me about how on the night Grace was shot, there'd been some kind of conflict that day, something to do with Charlotte and Bo leaving or something. And I wonder if just maybe Beverly had the story backwards. It wasn't Charlotte and Bo that were leaving, it was Grace and Gary. And that's what set Bo off. That would mean it was a crime of passion, almost. Plotted a few hours in advance, maybe, but not methodically planned days in advance. And if Bo was that angry, if he was set off by something, wouldn't Gary have noticed something, or shouldn't there have been some kind of sign? Actually, there may have been. That day, before Grace was shot, Bo had wrecked a car and then tried to start a fight with Gary.
I wish I could remember word for word. I can't remember. It took me by surprise that, first of all, he survived the wreck and climbed out of the car cussing, raising hell like I caused the wreck. This was all my fault, you know. But that was a strange, thinking back on it. It was weird because we had no words whatsoever, ever. It was strictly business stuff with him and Richard and me.
Gary doesn't recall exactly what it was that Bo was yelling about, and he doesn't recall Grace being mentioned. One thing he does remember Bo saying is, "I'm not afraid of you or your guns." Gary had recently bought an imitation machine gun. Not a real machine gun, but a replica that kind of looked like one. And Bo knew about it. They'd even gone and practice shot it together. And as far as Gary can tell, that's what Bo was referencing. But Gary's not really sure what any of that means. The wreck was always part of the story about what happened that day, but he's never given it much importance. It's just something that happened. I became interested in it because of the possible implications it had about how Grace got home from the beer joint that night. Since Charlotte had to drive Bo home in Grace's car due to the wreck, it meant Grace didn't have a car of her own. After talking to Lana, though, I began to wonder if the car wreck was significant for another reason. And if perhaps I dismissed the story as meaningless simply because I hadn't known how to make sense of it at the time. We'll never know what exactly was going through Bo's head when he crawled out of that wrecked car and started raising Cain and fussing at Gary, but it does lend a little support, at least, to the idea that Bo could have had some kind of personal motive that day for hurting Gary. And that brings us to the last big thing from Lana's story. The part that, at least to me, was the biggest WTF out of everything Lana had to say. because Bo told her that he'd committed the murder in a way I'd never considered, never even entertained the possibility of it happening. He'd told her that Grace had been shot not by someone in the kitchen, but by someone standing outside and firing through the kitchen window. Summers in Georgia are hot and muggy, and there was no air conditioning in the Maple Street house, so the window itself would have almost certainly been open. The idea that a shot came through the window, it's possible, anyway. Or rather, it's possible that a shot came through the window. What is not possible is that all of them did. Without a record of the crime scene, without photos, without an autopsy, there's only so much we can know for sure. But what's as near certain as can be is that there were 4 or 5 or 6 shots that hit Grace, and at least 5 or 6 shots in all. And at least one shot was presumably fired down after Grace had already fallen and went through her to strike the floor. Still, could one of the shots have been fired through the window? I don't know. I have stared at photos and house diagrams and Google Maps and tried to make sense of it all, but at the end of the day, I have to conclude that I can't conclude one way or another. Without a record of the crime scene, of the bullets, the basic details, pretty much anything could be possible here. But one of the shots that night failed to hit its target. It struck the backsplash of the kitchen counter instead. And intriguingly, but maybe misleadingly, that stray gunshot hit directly across from the kitchen window. Then again, maybe that's just a coincidence. There is one common detail, though, between Beverly's stories and Gary's stories that may offer a clue here. When Gary describes his memories of the shooting, his story is often as wild and flexible as Beverly's. All kinds of possibilities are entertained, sort of a dreamlike reconstruction of events. But one detail is always the same. Gary goes to the kitchen and gets some ice. They didn't have a freezer, so they'd bring ice home from the bar and put it in the sink to use. And it's always just as Gary gets to the sink, gets to the ice, that he hears a gunshot and all hell breaks loose. It's just one shot he hears. He never remembers hearing more, and it's always at the sink. Beverly tells that part of the story in a similar way. When that first shot rings out, Gary is always at the sink.
Boy, did you see me shoot her?
The what?
Did you see me shoot her?
Well, that's all I remember, seeing you standing at that kitchen sink.
So you didn't see me shoot, you didn't see me fire a gun?
I did not say like I said in court. I never seen your gun shoot. And I told you, I would be willing to go under fucking hypnosis. I would go under two serum if I knew the truth. Because, Gary, all I remember swearing before you and God is you standing at that thing. That's all I remember.
Beverly's stories about the next 4 or 5 shots are all over the place. There's not much consistency to them. But there is one version of the story that she's told several times, although it makes attorneys very frustrated every time she tells it.
Can you now say it for how long between the first shot and the other 5?
10 minutes before I got to the door.
You mean it was that long, honey?
Yeah.
Now 10 minutes is a... Now, I'm not trying
to... It's a long time.
I'm not trying to back you up, but I mean... From the time that you heard the first shot until the other 5, it was 10 minutes of elapsed.
I laid on that bed from 5 to 10 minutes before I got up to the door.
Why did you wait so long?
I don't know. I was scared.
But the most believable part of Beverly's story, at least to me, is that she was too scared to move when the shooting happened. And I think, maybe, possibly, she heard 2 different shootings while hiding there. The first shot... when Gary's at the window, that's like she and Gary always describe. But it wasn't until 5 or 10 minutes later that a shadow came into the kitchen, and 4 or 5 more shots were fired. And if Grace hadn't been dead already, she was dead by the end of that. Only it wasn't a shadow, because shadows don't leave bloody footprints. And shadows don't carry away guns so that they're never found. And shadows don't usually have the same profile as Richard Holcomb. Perhaps Beverly's stories about the shadow are made up too, but I think they could be true. The shadow that had the same general height and build of a man who could have been either Gary or Richard, maybe that happened, and maybe Beverly guessed wrong. Because even though Bo may have told Lana that he was behind the murder, that he carried it off, that doesn't mean that part's the whole truth. And what I do know is that in every single crime Beau has committed at any point in his life, that I have a record for, Beau didn't do the crime alone. He always had an accomplice. Always. Even when having an accomplice was a terrible idea that did nothing to help out the plan, he'd invite friends along. And if Mystery Man and Ray Allman are telling the truth, Richard was telling people that Beau had invited him along to this crime too. And all of this is just a guess, but it's the best way I have to make sense of everything I know. I'm still hoping to find more evidence, more witnesses who might remember things, and maybe they can help fill in gaps here. But for now, this is what I have, and I think my guess is a lot closer to what really happened than is the version of events the state told at Gary's trial. All of which would mean that Beverly was lying at Gary's trial when she testified. Whatever the truth is there, of all the people who contributed to Gary's conviction, she is the only one who ever tried to make it right, even when it came at great personal expense to herself.
But I want you to know, when and if this all comes to a head, okay? I hope that you forgive my testimony, because I really believe that you killed Mama. I didn't.
Well, Beverly...
I have my doubts. I told my husband. I told my mother-in-law. I live the fact that you killed my mama. But I always doubted you killed my mama.
Well, you asked me to forgive you on April 8, 1975 for what you did on the witness stand against me, and I forgave you then. And I forgive you now. I have, you know, I've forgiven you years ago.
One of the ironies of this case is that Beverly may be the one person who can best understand what Gary has gone through and what it cost him, because she's gone through it herself. After her confession, Gary, his family, the people working on the case, they all thought Beverly had killed Grace, and at times, her own family thought the same. And due to the false swearing charge, Beverly also ended up serving time in prison for her mother's murder.
I really think her pain is as real as yours. She doesn't know what happened, and she wishes she did.
I do too. And what bothers me, like you said, how you felt in that interview with her, and me going back through these tapes and all these years, I hear myself on some of these tapes and I think, God almighty, I wish I'd have never said that. I wish I hadn't have been so tunnel vision toward her. I always felt like the other people were involved in it. I didn't know how, but after she confessed to it, that's what I had. That's what I kept believing. But this last year, since you got involved, and you told me what you believe, and then when me re-listening to these tapes and hearing that girl was pitiful, sorry, brokenhearted, and I felt like a jerk. My God, why did I've been accusing her as much as the law's been accusing me. I'm as bad as them on her.
As for Charlotte, I still don't know what to make of her stories. I think most of them may just be meaningless noise, things cobbled together from transcripts and statements of other people to fit a narrative she wants to tell. Talking to Charlotte didn't give me any useful answers, because almost all the stories I heard were stories I'd heard before, it's just they were told by someone else at the time, usually Beverly. And as far as Charlotte is concerned, everything in the GBI's files about her is a made-up story that the GBI made up for God knows why. But she has nothing more to contribute there. But Lana knew Charlotte personally, and she knew how things were between Charlotte and Beau. So I do give weight to her view on the dynamics between them and about why Charlotte might have been willing to lie about what had happened on the night her mother died.
Yeah, I know Charlotte was terrified of him, and I'm sure people look on Charlotte and think you were a sorry person. I look on Charlotte and think he knew that he could control her. He knew he could get her to say and do anything he asked her to do.
She was a lot younger than he was.
Oh my gosh, she was a kid. Yes.
As for Beau himself, His story mostly ends after his conviction in 1981. He was never paroled from his life sentence, and he spent the rest of his days in prison. Beau and Charlotte had three children together, all of them very young when Beau went away. And after that, the children's lives were turned upside down. It wasn't until they grew up and became adults themselves that they ever got a chance to know their father and have a relationship with him. Beau had done terrible things in his past. He acknowledged that to them and expressed regret for what he'd done. But to his kids, he was not the same person who had gone to prison all those years ago. They were with him in the hospital when he died in 2005. The last time Gary saw Beau was in November of 1977. It was at his final post-conviction hearing down in Carroll County. Beau was at the court because he'd actually testified at that hearing, though he didn't say much on the stand. Mostly he just laughed about how he'd been so drunk he couldn't recall anything about what had happened. But for a lot of reasons, that hearing had been pretty brutal on Gary. The judge had mocked his father and threatened to lock his sister up, and then issued a swift ruling from the bench denying his petition. Once court was over, after Gary had lost his motion, he went out into the hallway, and he saw Beau.
We had come out in the hall and had lost, and he come out and he said, the wheels of justice turn slow.
Beau told you that?
Beau said that out in the hall at the Carroll County Courthouse. The wheels of justice turn slow. My sister talked about that for a long time. She always remembered that.
Initially, I'd assume that this exchange had been Beau's way of mocking Gary, of taunting him on losing what was almost certainly his last legal challenge to his conviction. But Gary told me no, it hadn't been that way at all.
It was more like it was, he could understand. You know, he wasn't taunting me, I don't think, and he wasn't mocking or whatever. It was more like, man, the wheels of justice turn slow, and kind of maybe disappointed for me is the way I remember, because I'm telling you, in the condition I was in with that judge, if it would have been a mockery or putting like, okay, well, you still ain't gonna get out of here, I'd probably struck, but it wasn't presented that he didn't say it that way.
I think that is likely the closest thing to an acknowledgement of his innocence that Gary will ever get from anyone who was involved in his case. But Gary's story didn't end there, and it's not over today. Legally, Gary is still guilty of Grace's murder. Georgia does have the power, though, to issue him a pardon on grounds of innocence. It's a slim chance, but it's a chance, and Gary is never giving up on his dream of one day finally clearing his name of a murder he didn't commit.
I know the story is ending, but it ain't ending. And I was talking with a friend one day, and I said to him, I've lived 26 years with this thing on my head. I've lived 43 years carrying it. If I could get exonerated, I wonder how much time I got left. I know I don't have as many years left as I've lived with it. But he said something to me, and he said, if it's one day, it'll be worth it. So that long shot that you're still talking about, and it's a long shot with a pardon and parole board, but I've lived long shots all my life.
And that's the last episode of Undisclosed, the State vs. Gary Mitchum Reeves. But stay tuned for this Thursday's addendum. John Cryer's back, and he'll interview me and Mitchum, and you won't want to miss it. As always, transcripts, case docs, and photos are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. And if you'd like to talk about the case with other listeners, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Reddit. This series has been a bigger undertaking than I think I realized when I started, and could never have been done without the help I've received along the way. First credit has to go to Christy Williams, my husband and in-house tech support, for his unfailing support and patience over the course of this project. He's a trooper. And a very special thanks also goes out to Dawn and Joseph Evans. Without their help, this podcast would have been a much shorter and much more incomplete story. Thanks also goes to Alexis Nemeth, who volunteered to help with some out-of-state research and did a fantastic job digging up new information related to this case, which unfortunately did not get covered on the show, but was no less appreciated for it. I am also grateful to our intern, Najabadi, who spent endless hours deciphering difficult sections of audio. And if you've used the episode transcripts to decipher some of the accents, You can thank Erica Fladell, Britta Bliss, Don Logis, and Skylar Park for their efforts to provide a transcript for every episode in this series. Finally, our sound editor is Rebecca Lavoie of the Crime Writers On podcast. If you like true crime podcasts and you're not listening to Crime Writers On, you're doing it wrong. Next Monday, we'll be back with a new episode about a new case and a new city. Actually, we'll be back with a new series of cases about the same new city. Because wrongful convictions don't happen in a vacuum. They aren't accidents. When the right conditions are in place, when the wrong people are in the wrong positions of authority, and when the system has decided not to look too closely at how the sausage is being made, wrongful convictions happen again and again. And even in a big city, sometimes the same names start to appear again and again.